and welcome to episode 12 of the War Pod from the Oxford Research Group's Remote Warfare Programme. My name is Liam Walpole. I'm the Policy Manager at Oxford Research Group. And today I'm joined by two experts from the Danish Institute for International Studies, Peter Albrecht and Sina Marie Kord-Refkeld. We are going to be examining the importance of protecting civilians and doing it effectively in conflict environments with a specific look at the Sahel and broader West Africa. Now, over the last few years, we have seen the UK and many of its allies increasingly turn their attention to the Sahel and the Horn of Africa, where they have stated aims of building stability and countering terrorist groups. Now, they do this mainly through remote warfare, and as we've explored in a lot of our previous work, just look at our website for the catalogue of research that we've done on this, including in two recent podcast episodes. And while this form of engagement is often presented as low risk, the reality is that the risks are just poorly understood. And this is perhaps especially true when it comes to effectively protecting civilians. Our two experts, Sina and Peter, will help us understand these challenges. Enjoy the show. Hello, Sina and Peter. Thank you for joining us for this podcast. Hello from Denmark. Hello from the UK. Now, if you could, we'd really like it if you could just briefly outline your own work, the research areas that you've been focusing on, before we get going with this fantastic podcast.
Okay, I can do that. My name is Sina Kold-Refkeld. I'm a senior researcher at DIIS. I've been working on local conflict drivers, peace and security, and also migration issues in the Sahel for more than a decade, and also a lot on international military actors' responses to the security crisis in the Sahel.
And I'm Peter Albrecht. I'm also a senior researcher at the Danish Institute for International Studies. My main focus has been on West Africa, and specifically and mostly on Sierra Leone and security sector reform. So basically how security sector reform is used as a peace building tool, instrument to rebuild institutions, and how that whole process relates to non-state actors such as chief traditional leaders and so on at the local level. And then I've also worked quite a fair bit on peacekeeping. So Sina and I wrote a report in 2017 about African peacekeepers in Mali. And from there, I've worked on peacekeeping both in on the Horn of Africa, but also now working on Ghana's role in peacekeeping and looking at how their sort of participation over the past 60 years has shaped the security sector back home, and that's both for the police and the military.
And you've recently written a report on that. Is that correct?
So there is one report coming out that is looking at protection of civilian from the perspective of the soldiers that protect. It's written with a researcher, professor at the King's College, Sukanya Potter. And it's looking at India and Ghana's role in peacekeeping and how they have responded to having to protect civilians. And it's something that we can also talk more about.
Fantastic. Brilliant.
In the podcast.
Wonderful. So the dynamic duo from DIIS.
That is correct.
Denmark. Fantastic. Well, one of the first questions that I wanted to ask you both, and feel free to chip in however you feel is relevant, is what you see from your research are the particular challenges when it comes to the protection of civilians in somewhere like the Sahel?
Well, I think actually it's one of the issues that Sina and I have looked at together, specifically how protection of civilian is carried out within MINUSMA, the UN mission in Mali. And taking it maybe one step, One of the things that was really clear is that there is sort of a racial dimension to protection of civilians. So basically, the forces that are least equipped, not very well trained, are the ones that are pushed out in these positions where they are actually expected to do protection of civilians. Whereas Western troops are more in specialized positions in the mission. So a lot of these troops basically do not have necessarily the capacity or the capacity to both protect themselves and also start protecting civilians. So there's this gap in capacity in terms of doing that. In specific case of MINUSMA as well in Sahel, is also a lot of the neighboring states that are involved in MINUSMA, and many of them are involved in MINUSMA because such as Niger, Burkina Faso, these types of countries are involved because they also worried about their own countries and the safety and security in their own countries. So it means that they are playing two roles. They're both part of the mission in Mali in order to stabilize Mali because of the implications for the region as a whole, and therefore also them, their countries. But of course, and then as I just alluded to, it's also to safeguard their own borders. It means that in practice, what we also have pointed out, and Sine has pointed out more than I have, but I pointed out once or twice, is that they are more concerned about actually safeguarding and defending the border regions with Mali, for instance, in the case of MINUSMA.
Yeah, I was thinking about, of course, there are also some contextual aspects to this. And I was recently in Mali in February, just before we were all pulled back because of a coronavirus. And I visited one of the internally, the more informal camps of internally displaced persons on the outskirts of Bamako, which was depicting very much people sitting on literally a dump site, barely 2 kilometers from the UN's missions headquarters. And though these people just represent a small number compared to the more than 200,000 internally displaced persons in Mali, adding also the ones that the more than 100,000 that are refugees in the neighboring countries, it became very clear to me that all these international responses that we have seen to the crisis in Mali have not addressed the question of protection of civilians. And as I said, there is also a context to that. When the UN became involved in the beginning, together with the French counter-terror operation, unlike other peacekeeping contexts, for MINUSMA, protection of civilians was among one of the priorities in what has been termed its Christmas tree mandate, pointing to how broad and manifold the scope of the mission's mandate was. But it was not a strategic priority at that point, because the UN was mostly focusing on establishing a peace agreement between combatant groups, and they were not so involved in directly attacking civilians at that point. So it was not a strategic priority until actually June 2019. And as the conflict has moved from the northern regions, where, you can also say it's not very densely populated, and jihadist actors has also gone local into this the center, this lack of protection of civilians has been extremely devastated. And you can say for MINUSMA, there is this idea that it has a very robust mandate, but the robustness has been mostly, and Peter and I have looked very much into this, has been mostly addressing the protection of MINUSMA's own forces, because they have been such a direct target for terrorist groups. But somehow this using all possible means to protect forces has not translated into using all possible means to protect civilians. And particularly in the central regions of Mali, which is a very complicated area with very diverse ethnic groups, historical disputes over natural resources, and also a region that borders Burkina Faso and Niger. And as we have seen these attacks spreading into the neighboring countries, this has been extremely visible and extremely problematic case for the UN. And as you can say, for civilians, there are three threats. There is the threat of jihadist groups. There's the threats of communal violence, but there is also the threat of counter-terrorist actors. And MINUSMA has also been very closely cooperating with both the French counter-terrorist force, but also the regional counter-terrorist forces, as well as the Malian army. And that has led to, also at the level of the UN, a large discussion about the risk of conflating counter-terrorist aims with protection of civilians, meaning that protection of civilians is not having the priority nor the resources that it should have. And we are seeing what we're seeing now is the consequences of that, you can say.
Is saying it's also, I think, Sina is really also speaking to the sort of a bigger, more global problem for the UN in terms of actually taking on this role as it, to protect civilians in a context where there's no peace to keep. So this is like a long and very old sort of like phrase to use about peacekeeping in a place like Mali. But the UN, and there's been a long and quite strong debate about this, is not equipped to actually take on this role in a context like Mali. And that, of course, shows how the UN has been pushed into a more stabilization-related role than actually doing peacekeeping without having the mandate, political will pushing behind it, but also the equipment to actually take on this role. And I think sort of that's a bigger debate that actually also it shows in the 90s, in the early 2000s, there were a lot of UN peacekeeping missions. There was an idea that would actually was a solution to a lot of conflicts around the world. But as the conflicts dynamics have changed from internal domestic, internal civil wars to much broader regional wars that are much more violent and where the mission suddenly becomes a target rather than supportive of peace. Obviously, the UN has shown its limitations in this respect. And Mali is the last mission that was actually established by the UN. And with Trump also saying that he wants to cut back the budget of. Yeah. Of the UN in terms of peacekeeping or in general, actually, it all obviously shows just how much under pressure the UN is, and it has how much it actually also has failed this role. And I think now actually seeing the Security Council how little smaller role it plays in the COVID-19 pandemic also shows that there's not a lot of faith in the UN. So that basically just to show a little bit about the sort of global political dynamic also of protection of civilians.
I was just going to say, I mean, it's from recent announcements from President Trump, he obviously is not in the mood for supporting UN bodies.
No, not at all. But I think also, I think another small thing to say is also, we talk about protection of civilians, but what are the contexts that we talk about this protection of civilian in when we talk about the Sahel? There was this sort of separation or division between the Maghreb in the north, Sahel in the middle, and then the Guinea coast on the southern part of West Africa. But I don't think we can make these sort of like quite clear distinctions about sort of conflict complexes that we're actually doing in West Africa as a whole. Burkina Faso, just north of Ghana, where I work, the Ghanaians are really, really worried about what's happening in Burkina Faso and how that will have implications for Ghana. So I'm also... The reason why I'm mentioning this is that, yes, we can talk about protection of civilians, but is any external actor actually able to play this role in the Sahel? And are we even talking about it in the right way when we're talking about the Sahel in isolation from West Africa and the broader sort of conflict dynamics in that region, where there has been a lot of conflict over the past 20, 30 years?
So, I mean, that leads into sort of the next question that I was going to ask you both is what do you think needs to change in terms of the current approach? And I mean, it is such a complex, if you look at somewhere like Mali, you've already talked about the UN, you've talked about G5 Sahel states being involved here, and you've also talked about, you know, the United States, the UN bodies. So, I mean, what do you think needs to change to make sure that these efforts can be sort of tied up to mitigate the dangers of civilian casualties and not putting enough resources into protection of civilians or prioritizing it is that the strategic level, as you were saying.
Yeah, I think and I think it's really interesting this thing that Peter's also saying that this thing with the entanglement of the regions, and you also see actors definitely not respecting borders, and this is also something jihadist actors can sort of draw upon in their call for a borderless jihad. Also interesting in how Europe is so occupied with borders, but I think there's also something that relates to this question of states, because I think sometimes in and also in the international efforts highlighting the regional dynamics, there is also this question of the state, and there is a tension in the relationship to host states, which I think and we can talk more about that when it comes to the question of security sector reform. But I sometimes see that there's this ambiguity between being a non-executive mission. Most of these international interventions, they are by invitation, but there's sort of a tension between them, this chapter 7 and using all possible means, and the problem is that you are and I think in Mali it's also very clear that the state is like a direct partner in the conflict. And but what you're also addressing in your series here, this aspect of remote warfare, I think there's this tendency that international actors, they also rely on to an increasing extent on regional actors to actually carry out these security actors. So that becomes a problem when then you cannot push these states that first they outsource security to militias, and we end up being perhaps because we know, I think most international actors agree that security sector reform is wanted or is needed, but it's not wanted by these, for instance, the Malian state. So you end up doing more sort of a training and equipping, having to maintain a very tensions and difficult relationship to host states, and I think that is actually one thing that we really need to address, because a lot of the atrocities that we see, I mean, last week there were circulations of FAMA, the Malian armed forces, beheading militants in the north of Mali. So what kind of complicity do we end up being in with supporting these very difficult security forces that is embedded in a particular very difficult culture? And my recent, because both the UN but also the European Union is very engaged in trying to do security sector reform, but all the European actors say that there is this question of sovereignty. The Malians don't want us to interfere. So how do you balance that, both having to push for reforms that could protect civilians, but you're dealing with a very unrepresentative state that doesn't really have the willingness to do so, and yet you rely on these people to actually carry out security for your own strategic interests?
I think sort of also listening to Sina, what I hear her say, apart from some very interesting analysis of Mali, is also how much can external actors actually do? Yeah. How much can we expect from the UK, from France, from the UN even, from the EU? What can we expect from them when they engage in a region that they, let's be honest, barely understand. Mm-hmm. It's also to understand a little bit more what are your intentions of going in? What is your motivation to go into Sahel? Is that to safeguard stabilize Mali and make Mali into a sort of like a beacon of hope for the region? Or is it to actually try to stabilize your own borders? And that's happening both in terms of what the regional actors are doing, such as the ones that are contributing, the African countries in the region that are contributing to MINUSMA, but is also happening, of course, as Sina has written extensively about, with the EU trying to stabilize its own southern borders and taking that that fight and that battle, if you can put it like that, to the Sahel, to Mali, rather than having people coming to the doorstep of the EU and knocking on the door. So when you're asking what has to change when you do protection of civilians well, you can say all the sort of things about stronger MINUSMA has to be, the troop contributing countries have to be better trained to do so. They have to be better equipped. We have to strengthen the central governments of the individual states so that they are capable of actually sort of protecting civilians against the jihadists. And we have to build up the socio-economic foundation so people have something to live off, so they do not pick up arms in the name of Allah, if you can put it like that.
Sure.
And
sure.
I think that those reasons have been said many times, but I think it's more also I think it's also not taking the geopolitics of this dynamic really seriously. Because it's not just about countries, it's about at the very, very local level, and it's about who's representing who, as Sina so eloquently put it before.
Yeah, I think you, this thing about Peter, you say the reason why people are, or why these Western states are contributing, because I think it's almost become too cynic, and sometimes I think that the questions of in-mission goals, are they even so important? Because there's also, as all these international actors has become engaged, I mean, the Sahel is a strategic priority for Europe. I think sometimes it more sold as if it's because of our own security interests, but I think it's as much about, with, as you're also speaking about, I mean, the US has been in the Sahel for decades, but there is a potential withdrawal of the US. So Sahel is and has also historically been an arena for showing capability of being an important security actor. And this have, of course, with this Sahel crisis become even more evident. So it's also about showing one's own ability to be an important security actor and also being in the right alliances. I think this discussion you were having about what is the UK's interests and strategic priorities with contributing is similar to what we've had in Denmark. And I think for Denmark, it's very obvious that with a sort of more unstable cross-Atlantic alliances, this alliance with France has been the most important driver. So are we then more interested in our allies and keeping up the relationships? And then this question of what actually happens on the ground is becoming less important. And I think that's really problematic, and that's going to end up biting us.
I think that's such an interesting point that you make, and something that's really important to this, because, you know, in conversations that we have had about the UK's proposed deployment to MINUSMA, which we're going to get onto a bit later, but I just wanted to make this point, is that, you know, the government has responded to questions from MPs, etc., about what it is that they're meant to be going to do. They're meant to be supporting the UN mission in providing intelligence to support UN headquarters. But in some of, when we've spoken to some of the personnel that are actually going to be deployed on the ground, they see it often as a way of bolstering the relationship with the French. So is it both? Is it that are we there to sort of ostensibly be supporting the UN mission when actually the priority is there to bolster our relationship with France? And I think it's that clarity that we need to understand before you can then discuss, you know, how are we prioritizing certain aspects around protection of civilians, or, you know, what is the sole purpose of us being in Mali, an area that the UK doesn't historically have much institutional knowledge about, as an area that has been largely, because of history, been an area that France has focused on, for example.
But I think also what you're touching on there, it's also a matter of why, what purpose, with what purpose does the UK send out its troops? What what brief are they given when they're told to go to Somalia, where I met a lot of British military personnel, to Sierra Leone, where I met a lot of them, and also now to Mali? What is actually the role that they are playing, and what role have they are they are they able to play within the remits that they're working? I mean, how much access do they have to people?
Yes.
Are they told to go out and speak to people, understand their culture, quote unquote, and then through that start to engage with the local population in order to really build up systems that are sensitive to the place where they are? No, that has nothing to do with whether they are in Sahel or in East Africa, where the UK has played a huge role, or on the coast in Ghana. That's not how they roll, basically. So I know that the next question is about civil society, and yes, there is maybe there's some answer in that, in terms of changing how you approach this. But the bottom line is that the UK is sending military staff as a state to another state to support that state, whatever that state is, in controlling the territory that it's governing. And I don't think you will find a lot of military persons officially understanding how to deal with this situation or deal with a place where they are differently. I mean, I could go into this a lot. I'm an anthropologist, and I've been working with a lot of UK military for the last 10 years and observing them and how they operate. And it is interesting. I mean, they come with a particular culture in approaching the work that they have been asked to do. And it's about solving a problem and continue to try to solve that problem until it's solved. And sometimes when it's unsolvable, it's rarely accepted. And we, really, I think here we are talking about a context in which they are problems that are unsolvable at least by external actors, and to an extent even also, and there Sina will have much more to say, by internal actors, because there's so many different interests at stake.
I'm going to bring in the civil society question into another one, but I just, on that point, because we're tapping into this now, this really interesting point about coordination, in terms of sort of the context of the UK coming in, and you know, something that we've done from our own research on the Sahel and the Horn of Africa is that coordinating with international actors and host governments and civil society, both in country and in the UK, are really, really important. But we found that there's sort of significant challenges when it comes to having that effective coordination. I think we've already sort of talked about some of those issues already, but I know that you've done a lot of research around this as well. And I just wondered if you could tell us what you have found when it comes to good practice around cooperation of countries in somewhere like the Sahel.
Yeah, I just also wanted to add that I think that this question of external actors, I mean, being a former French colony, the question of French interests in this area is, of course, very important. And there is tons of rumors around also among local actors and all the people I know and talk to, intellectuals have wide variety of conspiracy theories about what the French want in the Sahel. And there is a lot of interesting aspects of that. But I think it's very important to say that, of course, the French are not neutral. And as we also saw in our study, Peter and I, and which is actually something that is similar in the different missions that I've looked at afterwards, is that when it comes to like the strategic positions that speaks into the Malian or relationship with the Malian government, it is often French liaison personnel sitting there, and there's a language barrier. So I think I hear from a lot of also, you know, other member state officers being in these missions that there is too much of French dominance sometimes, and people are sort of in a lot of other membership countries feel in a position of inferiority because they don't speak the language as well and all that, and because the French, of course, has a much more deep historical relationships. But I want to stress that point, and also coming to what you're asking, this thing about coordination, because I think it's something that is on everybody's lips these days. But what does it actually mean in practice? Does it mean that each it's difficult enough to plan operations in a place like Mali? Do you then have to coordinate with everybody? And I think also that, and talking to this thing about some perhaps donor cooptation, I think maybe we can also acknowledge that maybe everybody doesn't have to do the same thing, because I think in the Sahel what we're seeing is that the donors end up being, you know, played a little bit around the Malians' game of, you know, negotiating in their favor. So I think sometimes it could also be helpful that that the different donors actually have different projects and different approaches. So I would just say that, of course, we shouldn't leave big gaps behind. And in certain areas, like what Peter and I also looked into, this question of sharing intelligence, much more could be done, particularly when it comes to protection of civilians. But I think there's also a need for a bit of a diversified donor strategy, because what we're also seeing with, for instance, the EU Trust Fund to the Sahel, mm-hmm. is that there is a tendency for smaller NGOs, civil society actors that cannot access the biddings. So because it's fast, some of the normal procedures for how you do biddings in the EU is actually thrown out with the bath water, which means that it's the big corporations and sometimes state-led corporations that gets the bids. And I think that's a problem in terms of engaging civil society actors, and also mm-hmm. this thing about mm-hmm. some donor cooptations.
So I think I think it's always, I always start with the, with when I talk about coordination, As I said, I looked at a lot of Sierra Leone. So basically in Sierra Leone, the UK was by far the dominant actor. They were the only ones really calling the shots, to the extent that all other donors, to an extent, but quite clearly were marginalized from actually strongly having anything to say in the security sector. But even there, you had sort of a dynamic between the FCO, DFID, and the MOD. So the turf wars between these three departments also playing out in Sierra Leone, who was actually the strategic lead in country, who had the money. DFID had the money. That has been a problem for FCO and MOD for a long time, specifically in terms of spending money the way that the DFID can. So my point is that even when it's only one country, there will be turf conflicts that have a detrimental effect on how programs are pushed forward, what types of alliances are made with the government, with which people within the government. Take it then to a place like the Horn of Africa, where the UK has had a strong historical role, but where there are many, many, many actors playing a role. The UN, the US, you have the whole, you have the Arabic countries, you have the neighboring countries as well. The UK will still try to do what's best nationally. They will try to push, for instance, counterterrorism legislation. They want to push legislation that can allow them to send people back from the UK legally to Somalia. And they will, that will not necessarily be in coordination with everybody else. That will be what is desirable in terms of national interest. Take then the UK now to Sahel, where they do not have a historical role to play. They have it on the coast, but they do not have it on in the Sahel to the same extent as Sina just said. What is that going to do to the UK in terms of actually going into a space where the French are very dominant? Will there be an acceptance that they are not they cannot push their agenda the same way that they have done in other places, or will they subsume and understand that they have sort of quote-unquote inferior role in the Sahel? And I think that's very interesting to see. I think very interesting about the UK, I think Brexit, we can't sort of like just ignore Brexit. And I know that France and Germany have said, well, we're going to work with we're going to disregard Brexit in our collaboration in Sahel. But I do think that Brexit, and I will not go too much into it, because I think I cannot speak to a British person without that person becoming a little bit sick, because we've been so much to it for the past many years. But it says something about how the UK also understands its role in the world, obviously. And do they take that understanding with them into a mission like that? And the reason why I'm saying that has huge implications for how you coordinate. When I was in Mogadishu, the only reason why the UK took us into some meetings about something relating to national security coordination in State House in Mogadishu was because we found out that they were doing something. they did not invite the UN to begin with, because the UN obviously is very low low in status. And I know how a lot of Brits, within the government looks at the UN. So will they accept to go into this space and be coordinated? And I think that is really one of the big problems.
Yeah,
I do disagree with Sina in terms of saying that it's okay if people do not coordinate. No, to an extent, because you can't tie people down to that extent, so they can't do anything without coordinating. And I understand the rationale of it, but I think in these contexts, doing something is not always the best thing. There's this tendency to say, as long as we at least do something, you know, because it's better to do something than nothing. And sometimes, actually, doing nothing is probably the best way to spend to act. So that you don't lose both resources, time, and energy on something that has no impact or influence, and at worst have really negative impact on the situation that you're trying to.
I think it also depends on, I was also speaking mostly about this thing about addressing civil society and donor monies, and I think it's fair, of course, if you're in one sector, you need, and that's also what they say in Mali, that everybody wants to coordinate, but nobody wants to be coordinated. But I still think that for a developmental point of view, and there are still a lot of development actors in the Sahel, for that point, I think it for civil society actors that people do work in different domains. I don't mean within the same sector, for instance, or when we speak about security sector reform. There's also too much sort of donor competition within the security sector reform, and I think that's not helpful for anything at all.
I was going to say, you know, I thought that was an interesting point that you made, Sina, about, you know, states perhaps doing their own thing, and I think perhaps it works if they're doing their own thing, as long as it doesn't undermine, you know, that what the overall objective is in Mali, right? I think that's the real challenge in terms of coordination, because it will be right that a state like Denmark will have very different priorities and very different capabilities to someone like the UK or France, but hopefully it would be doing something in a way that contributes to the overall objectives of that mission, rather than just doing its own thing and undermining that goal. So I think that's maybe an important context, and something that we've argued as part of our recent report on what the UK is calling fusion doctrine, but, you know, remote warfare, UK's remote warfare across Africa, is about having coordination, as we talked about, in the CRLO context between the departments, but also in country among different partners as well. And I think the point you raise about the UK as acting as an inferior partner, I wouldn't use that terminology if I was speaking to a British Army officer, but maybe a junior partner would be a way to start dialogue. I think this is another area that we have looked at as well, in terms of, is the UK prepared? And you've got two countries that are in a way somewhat similar in terms of their attitudes about themselves, with the French and the British. You know, how does that relationship work in practice? And I think the language barrier that you were discussing earlier as well, in terms of if the French are going to force, you know, their way of doing things, they've got 4,500 troops on the ground, you know, they've got more skin in the game, as it were. You know, they're able to perhaps then act as the coordinator in that sense, because they have, just from presence, they feel like they have more of a role in doing that. I'm very conscious of time. We're nearly 40 minutes in, and I just wanted to quickly turn to a question about something that I think Sina and Peter, you've both sort of addressed in your research, is, you know, the number of civilians in somewhere like Mali or the Sahel that are turning against international interventions. And I think it feeds into all these things that we have been discussing already. But I just wondered why that seems to be happening now, and increasingly so, what the consequences are of this. And does that reflect, going back to that civil society point, does it reflect that there is a lack of understanding of the population on the ground? You know, we talked about the socioeconomic issues that are, you know, playing into the extending the conflict as well. Just if you could provide some analysis on those very complex questions.
So I think, I mean, again, I think that's a very interesting point and sort of also an issue to discuss. Peacekeeping, if we take MINUSMA, has gone, as we just discussed earlier, from an attempt to sort of like attempt to stop two parties from fighting, basically, and being in the middle of between them on a border, so they stop fighting, basically. And now it's much more political. It's much more sort of like unclear actually who are the parties to the conflict, and therefore it becomes more politicized, these missions, it also becomes clear that these missions are taking sides. So I think both in the Horn, they're taking side with the federal government, but certainly also in Mali. Of course, MINUSMA has a mandate to work with the government in Mali, so they cannot take sides with all these groups that are running around in Mali in this fight. So therefore, they become very partial to the conflict, and it's obviously one of the sort of the key concepts or key sort of like the ethos of peacekeeping is impartiality. So I don't think that you can sort of boil it down to saying people just don't understand how well-meaning we are in the UN, when the UN is working with a government that also has a political agenda,
sure,
actually pushing a certain way of either suppressing other people or making, I use this term, order in a territory that will be detrimental to certain groups or individuals. So if you start reforming the security sector, if you start reforming the military, if you start reforming the government, some people will lose out when you do that, because some people will lose access to resources that they're used to having access to. And that means that they will resist. And it's basically the same whether you're talking about the government and doing security reform within pharma or the military, or you're trying to do it regionally, it still has the same effect. And therefore, it becomes partial, and therefore, it cannot be seen as impartial to civilians on the ground.
Sina, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think my thoughts is perhaps, and excuse me for being a little bit Sahelian context specific, but I think also, since the French started Operation Serval, which then became Barkhane, and since 2016, more than 1,500 people have been killed. And I mean, the spiral of violence in central Mali has just reached like an all-time high. Last year, was the deadliest, with more than 800 killed, and one of these massacres was and it was right after those massacres were in a village that was burned down and more than 150 people died, and the international actors was not there, and that act sort of spurred all these very big protests in Bamako, and I have been there while they have taken place, because they really show, I think, to local people that, I mean, the international actors, despite the presence, despite that Mali has more than 25,000 foreign soldiers in the country, there is no stabilization. On the contrary, we are seeing attacks every day. Rumors are that Pharma is underestimating the numbers of people being killed by jihadist actors, because they also need to recruit to their armies. And people know somebody who has died from this. And that just leads into this question that people are saying, how can it be that all these well-equipped actors cannot just, when the French come in, similar to Vietnam, when you have had this guerrilla war, why can they not wipe out these few thousand men?
Sure. Yeah.
And I think that definitely is what also spurs the legitimization of international actors. And then, of course, the colonial heritage and the fact that a lot of it's not just Western actors. And I think that's something maybe you need to take a look at in the next podcast. But there's also a lot of other actors or non-liberal actors, like the Russia is there, the Gulf states. Everybody's looking to the Sahel, and everybody, the Chinese are there. Everybody's there to spy on each other. So there's maybe we want to withdraw, but there's also this question that I think that the Western actors are asking themselves: who's going to fill that gap if we withdraw? Right. So. And that just means that we're also entering this fourth sphere of war, which is the cognitive warfare, that rumors and fake news and fake conspiracy theories are flourishing on social media about what do the French want. We see videos where there's French officers showing jihadists where they should attack and things like that. And a lot of different actors can pick up on that and use that strategically. So I just want to emphasize that a lot is at stake here in terms of gaining legitimacy. And I think that the Western actors should not underestimate the importance of legitimacy towards local populations, not just their partners in the field.
But also, like, with good reason to be suspicious of what the French are doing in the Sahel, right? I mean, when you're looking what they have actually done, both in Chad and in Mali, there's good reason to also be what is actually the agenda of the French in the region. That's not always clear that that's to the benefit of the local population, I think. Yeah. And not just the French. I mean, that could
definitely
be any...
Well, you've nearly spurred me on to ask another question, which I'm gonna resist because I'm really interested in that point about Russia and China, and I think it's a topic that comes up a lot in, when we discuss, you know, what the UK's role is. You know, is it providing, is it of benefit the UK training up these different state forces? And people often come back to us and say, well, if we're not there, then Russia and China will be there. But I think you raise a really good point, which is that China and Russia are already there. So, you know, the dynamics are very different when you look at it from that context. It's not like Russia and China aren't already present in some of these places. But yes, I think that's probably a topic for another podcast. I wanted to end. I know we have discussed this a bit throughout the podcast, but look, the UK is still, as things are planned, I believe, deploying to the UN mission in Mali, as we've been talking about. What advice do you have for the UK government with this impending deployment?
Good luck.
No. Peter, you go first.
I think with my knowledge, as we just discussed before, I think this going in with sort of an idea that the UK is actually a junior partner in this, I think that would be quite helpful in terms of if that would be sort of possible for the UK to do that in a context like Sahel, because even though it is an important actor internationally and it remains so, the UK, despite its treacherous leaving the EU, it's also going into a region where it has played a limited role and therefore there has a limited understanding, and also there are a lot of other actors there already playing quite a big role. So I think if you take up that junior position, you also sort of like take a step back and maybe try to understand the context in which you're operating, that you can then use to do more stronger programming. I'm also a little bit sort of like looking for something to say here, because I feel also the issues that are at stake are so massive and so dramatically massive, then that what can actually be said in one sentence or in five sentences to the UK that would make it fundamentally easier for it to play a strong role in the Sahel. So I will leave it to Sina to do that.
And what about the specific point around, you know, protection of civilians? What can the UK expect to contribute with?
But I think there you're playing into sort of what we talked about in the very beginning. But the UK is not going to do the protection of civilians. It's going to be other troops. As far as I understand it, that are actually going to do the physical protection.
Yes.
And the physical protection is where the problem is. The problem is that MINUSMA's forces, if Burkina Faso is feeling that its own territory is under threat, it will sort of intuitively go to its own territory and try to defend that, rather than do protected civilians. If it feels that its base is under attack, it will go to its base within Mali to protect that before it protects civilians. And it that has to do with capacity, that has to do with the ability to actually do the protective surveillance, and maybe also a unclear political brief from back home. And
yeah,
I think
sure.
The UK, what would it look at like practically? Would it be that the UK go to Niger, goes to Burkina Faso and tells them, guys, you really need to do protection of civilians because it's very important for the mandate of MINUSMA? They will look at them and say, okay, then you do it. I mean, you can see how easy it is. So I think the UK cannot, what is needed in terms of protective civilians is that all the countries that are doing that are the providing the troops really show that they're willing to go that out on the line. They will risk their lives to actually fulfill the mandate, and not all countries are willing to do that. So I, as I just said, just very briefly, this report that we've been writing on protection of civilians, looking at Ghana and India, that are in the top 10 of peacekeeping troop contributors in the UN system. They will both, so they will, they, so India will say, we will not do protective civilians unless it's less dangerous for us, because we cannot be pushed in front of the Western troops and actually play this role. Ghanaian troops are a little bit different. It's often in Africa, so they have this feeling that they are actually helping their, you know, compatriots from across Africa, and they actually do see people in South Sudan, other places in Mali, as sort of as people that they somehow have a relationship to, due to to geographical proximity. They will never, they will not say that they won't go that extra mile or sort of push it to that extent. They will just not do it, because they will also try to protect themselves from actually getting into a situation where a lot of people are killed, where the government has to suddenly start sort of legitimizing why soldiers being sent to these places. So my point is probably that I'm struggling to give a good sort of like advice to the UK troops, and thankfully they're not paying me to do that either. So, you know, they're not losing out in terms of doing protection of civilians, because it's not just difficult for the UK, it's actually difficult for everybody that is being asked to do that. And it just so happens that countries in the region are more willing to send troops into very difficult circumstances than Western countries are.
I think you speak to that really important point as well about, you know, the UK providing a supporting role, and it's these other state actors that will be set in to do the protection. I think.
Yeah, I mean, let's be very honest. There is a racial dynamic and dimension to peacekeeping that is very unpleasant to talk about. And and I think that's what I'm talking about here as well. It's basically black people that are being put on the front line of MINUSMA, and the white people are sitting in camps that are much better protected, much further away from the front line, and the conditions of service are much better. I mean, it's Sien and I saw that in 2017-18, and I've seen after as well. It was striking, don't you think, Sien?
Yeah, there's definitely an issue of bunkerization and very different exposure to threats within the different contingents in the missions. But I would still say, if I should answer a question to what the UK should, I still think there are different levels, but from a strategic level, I think first of all it's still important to prioritize the UN globally, because I don't know what we have if we don't have the UN. And I also think that as I started out by saying that it was in June 2019 that actually this question of protection of civilian has finally become one of the second strategic priorities also in the center of Mali. So that is perhaps a moment. So the UK in that sense comes in at a moment where perhaps there is a time and willingness to actually prioritize this. And because there can still be a gap between what is then addressed as the strategic priorities and then the resources that are then allocated. And MINUSMA, as Peter and I has also said many times, is overstretched in terms of covering a large territory, in terms of not being filling the troop ceiling, etc. But so there needs to be prioritizing, and that prioritizing needs to resources has to follow that. So perhaps the UK, instead of just playing the junior role, can also, of course, with the fear of seeing now this old colonial power competition playing out in MINUSMA, would be very sad. Yeah. They can
it's
also be strategic about what they want to achieve, and push for that. I think there is still a need and possibility for doing that.
That's really, really fascinating. And I think that's some really interesting points that we can definitely reflect on and the UK can take on board. Sina, Peter, thank you very much for taking part in this podcast. We will hopefully speak to you soon, and you'll join us for another podcast. But thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Liam.
Well, thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as we did. Now, As ever, for anyone who wants to read in more depth about the topics that were covered in the podcast, we put links to any research or publications that we have mentioned in the episode notes. Go and check them out. And if you want to stay up to date with the Remote Warfare program or any of the programs at the Oxford Research Group, please do subscribe to our newsletter by clicking on the button at the top of the page. We'd also really appreciate if you could offer a comment, your feedback about what you thought of this podcast, but other podcasts that we've also recorded and produced over the last couple of months. Now, I shouldn't forget that you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handles are at ORGinfo and at remote_warfare. You can listen to all the previous podcasts that we've ever recorded free of charge by following the link at the top of the page. I hope you will join us again for our next episode very soon. Goodbye.